From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two Reuters reporters were freed today and reunited with their families after more than 500 days in jail in Myanmar. Hua Lone and Chaso Wu were convicted of violating the country's Official Secrets Act in their coverage of the military's crackdown on the Muslim group the Rohingya, something observers called ethnic cleansing. In April, while the two were still in prison, they were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting for their work. Today, Hua Lone thanked their supporters.
Inside, in the prison, and also around the world, people who are wishing to release us. So I would like to say thank you very much for everything. I'm really happy and excited to see my family and my colleagues. And I can't wait to go to my newsroom.
I can't wait to go back to my newsroom. Joining us now, the BBC's Nick Beek. He's in Yangon, Myanmar. And Nick, you were there. They were mobbed by fellow reporters outside the jail.
Yeah, they were, Robin. And I mean, these are reporters who are well loved by the journalistic community here in Yangon. And you know, for lots of reporters and photographers, people in the journalistic crowd here in Myanmar, they saw this as an attack on the whole community, really. And I think it had a chilling effect because lots of people thought that they too could have ended up in a prison cell if they were telling the truth, trying to do the right thing as they saw it.
Well, just remind us what happened here, because just last month, Myanmar's Supreme Court rejected their appeal. So what changed?
Well, it's really hard to say what changed, but it does seem that Aung San Suu Kyi, the effective leader of Myanmar, she's made a decision that there's been enough international condemnation here. And she, in her mind, has decided that these men should be freed. As you say, there was a long legal process. They had a first appeal, which was rejected, a second appeal, which was then rejected. And what we've seen today is an amnesty. And basically, this is all to do with the Burmese New Year. Often you get political prisoners released as a goodwill gesture. This has been a pretty unprecedented third wave of releases. So we were waiting over the last couple of weeks to see if they'd be set free, and today they have, and jubilation for their friends and family. And outside court where we were just a few hours ago, chaotic but also really happy scenes as they will return to their colleagues and family.
Well, and you spoke to Hua Lone, and he told you he never will stop being a journalist. But we're wondering now, how can they possibly, the pressure on them as they work now, it seems will be pretty incredible.
Well, this is it. I mean, these were guys who came up with this investigation, which was really forensic in its detail. They won, as you say, the Pulitzer Prize for their efforts. They basically forced an apology from the Myanmar military. If not an apology, an admission of guilt that soldiers murdered 10 Rohingya men in Rakhine State in late 2017. Now, the army here just does not come forward to say, hey, look, you know, we committed these crimes. So their journalistic work was watertight. Nonetheless, they were, you know, charged under this British colonial era act of the Official Secrets Act. They were sentenced for 7 years in prison. And so to prison they went until today when they were released.
Well, you mentioned Aung San Suu Kyi. This is, of course, the Nobel Peace Prize winner who, you know, took office in 2016, a civilian government, a lot of hope that there would be, you know, sunshine and fresh air in the government after military rule. Those hopes were dashed with, again, what the UN is calling this ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya. Does this release maybe have something also to do with her trying to repair her reputation?
Well, it could well be, because until this point, Robin, we've got no indication that Aung San Suu Kyi has been listening to the international world and this crushing pressure that's been on her to do something, to, you know, stand up for the Rohingya people, which, of course, is the story these two reporters were investigating. But we've seen she hasn't given any sympathy towards the Rohingya Muslim minority in her country, the 750,000 people who were forced from their homes amid this brutal clearance operation by the army. And similarly, there was no sympathy for these journalists. And that, you know, surprised a lot of people, because when she was under house arrest for some 15 years, she relied on journalists to get her message out there. She was seen as a, you know, a beacon of democracy, someone who really championed human rights. But, you know, when push came to shove, she wasn't willing to stand up for these reporters. Now, we haven't heard anything from her, but I think what people around her would suggest to us, if we were having a chat with them today, they would say, look, Aung San Suu Kyi didn't want to get involved with the legal process. She's let that take its course, and now she's in a position to grant them an amnesty, to set them free, and that she's fulfilled her part of the bargain here. I think that's the sort of narrative they'd like to take.
Well, there's certainly going to be a lot of reporters like yourself in Myanmar now watching closely to see how these two reporters are treated. And I'm sure they're going to be continuing their look at the treatment of the Rohingyas. So we will all keep an eye on that. The BBC's Nick Beek in Yangon, Myanmar. Thank you, Nick.
Good to talk to you, Robin.
Well, yesterday's report from the United Nations warning of mass extinction across the globe specifically mentioned ecosystems managed by indigenous peoples. They're not declining as fast as other areas. Here in the U.S., some Native American tribes are using techniques to sustain healthy forests and repair land that's been damaged since the 19th century when settlers spread out across the West. Brian Bull of KLCC in Eugene, Oregon reports.
We're about 60 miles west of Portland, Oregon, and Michael Wilson, Natural Resources Manager for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, is showing off parts of the roughly 14,000 acres of forest under tribal management.
Yeah, these trees over here are probably a good 70 years old. Back over here are some of those ones we saw down by the stream bank, 80, 90 years old. Down to these, I think these are probably 3 years old.
Wilson says compared to forests managed by timber companies and the federal government, tribal forests tend to have more diversity in their trees and plants, which includes huckleberries and hazel, traditional food and basket weaving materials. Trees are thinned to accommodate foraging areas for elk and deer. Brush is cut by hand instead of using herbicides. And prescribed burns control tinder buildup and encourage beneficial growth along the forest floor. Driving by forest land that borders the reservation, Wilson points to a ridge that's been clear-cut by a regional timber company. He acknowledges there's profit potential in many old-growth forests both on and off the reservation.
You know, $350, $500, depending on which tree. Some of the bigger ones, $800. If you start adding those up, that's a lot of dollars. But if you look at, you know, what we're doing over the long stretch, maybe it won't ever pencil out as far as a good financial decision. But as far as providing habitat and long-term health of the tribe's reservation, we're definitely doing the right thing.
Right enough to get recognition, says Don Motanik of the Intertribal Timber Council based in Portland. He says independent 10-year assessments of tribal forests compared to federal forests highlighted two major differences.
One is that tribal forestry programs function at one-third of the cost as compared to the Forest Service. It's $9 an acre for the Forest Service and $3 an acre for tribes. Second key point they make is that tribes are models of sustainability because some of the programs have been in existence over 100 years.
Another study by the Property and Environment Research Center, or PERC, compared timber returns between the Lolo National Forest and the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana. PERC found that over a 7-year period, tribal timber revenues exceeded $16 million, nearly 7 times more than what the U.S. Forest Service was bringing in.
The key thing is knowing their own land and understanding their language.
Motanik says unlike timber companies, tribes don't up and move once an area has been harvested. The land is part of the tribe and its culture, and is managed for the sustenance and appreciation of future generations, not solely for the bottom line. Mike Wilson of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde says to keep a forest healthy, it's important to stay vigilant.
Invasives can come in really, really quick, and they're so persistent, it's tough to keep a handle on it. Beyond that, it's population growth, there's more people out there, dispersed camping, campfires, recreation, hunters, fishers, just monitoring that.
For both tribal and federal land managers, familiar challenges exist. Invasive species, wildfires, and climate change threaten all forests, and partnerships are budding. Last July, the Forest Service formalized a plan of tribes near the California-Oregon border for managing the Klamath Forest region. In addition, the latest farm bill has tribe-friendly provisions, including one that lets tribes set up self-governance demonstration projects to manage federal lands adjacent to Indian reservations. Darren Jarnigan is a Hoopa Indian who serves as the Coquille Tribe's Director of Natural Resources. As we drive towards the tribe's forest, he explains that the goal is to make sure that members have access to historically what was here on this landscape and what was managed historically for tribal purposes.
Not only just the present economic return, but thinking about what the forest is going to be for the generations to come and leaving something better than you found it, so to speak.
For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull.
Well, this week marks the 25th anniversary of the Channel Tunnel, which runs under the English Channel, linking the UK to France and the rest of Europe.
Ladies and gentlemen, this human statue in Paris is now ready to leave. And a door will be closed.
You can get on a train at London's St. Pancras International Station and be in Paris in less than 3 hours. It is a wonder of engineering. Used to call it the Channel, now I guess it's just the Channel Tunnel. It stretches more than 23 miles. It is the longest undersea tunnel in the world. And because of the delay in Brexit, Brits can still use the EU passport line when they board the train until at least October. A new play called Socrates by writer, filmmaker, and actor Tim Blake Nelson tells the story of the Greek philosopher who lived in Athens in the 5th century BCE and is considered one of the founders of Western philosophy. Here's Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays Socrates on stage at the Public Theater in New York.
The worthwhile person must consider only this. Do I act rightly or wrongly? Am I a good man or bad? And were you to say to me, right now, Socrates, we will let you go free, but you must stop philosophizing or face death, I would answer that I will not stop, but will keep pursuing, questioning everyone I meet, saying, you, Athenian, why do you seek wealth and power and every comfort, but refuse to ask what your life and the world around you might actually mean?
Socrates explored issues by asking a series of questions, looking to expose contradictions and faulty arguments, but later got in trouble with the law before he eventually took his own life. The playwright, Tim Blake Nelson, joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, and for those of us who haven't taken a classics course or read ancient Greek philosophy in a long time, first of all, just give us a very brief synopsis of the story of Socrates that you're trying to tell in this play.
Socrates was a self-described gadfly who traveled around Athens, questioning anyone with whom he could have a conversation, who would agree to be questioned, allowing them to question him as well, in search of either truth or some sense of what is good and what is bad. He was primarily an ethicist as a philosopher, who got sideways with the powers that were in Athens and was eventually tried on three counts, one of corrupting the youth of Athens, another one of worshiping unsanctioned gods, and another one of practicing atheism. He was sentenced to death, and in carrying out that sentence, he took his own life by drinking hemlock. That's the bare-bones description of who the guy was.
And what is his enduring legacy today, do you think?
Socrates gave us a method for the pursuit of knowledge, truth, wisdom, good and evil that is still used to this day. We call it the Socratic method. But Socrates, through the writings of Plato, who was his student, introduced us in the written form to what we call the dialectic, posing arguments that might come together in pursuit of a unifying truth.
Like the debates that we have now
That's
all
exactly
the time.
Right. Not that Socrates invented that form. He was just the best guy at practicing it in 5th century Athens.
And your play is set in ancient Greece shortly after the founding of democracy. What ideas about democracy did you want to delve into by telling the story of Socrates?
Well, what I did not want to do in this production is this hagiographic sanctification of Socrates. Mm-hmm. We're in pursuit of the human being. who was flawed, some might say narcissistic, callous, intolerant. But one of the focuses of his questioning was the efficacy of democracy. And democracy in Athens had a very limited appreciation, at least in its practice, of what we'd call right now the Bill of Rights. And so in exploring democracy in the play and in going after democracy as something sacred in Athens, mm-hmm. A kind of third rail, particularly around the time Socrates was put on trial, which was right when Athens was coming out of tyranny at the hands of the Spartans, Socrates wondered about what sort of leaders were put in charge, why people voted the way that they voted, whether it was because they were vulnerable to the rhetoric of great speakers mm-hmm. or because they actually had studied the topics at hand. And he suspected it was the former, that Athens had become a place in which the power of democracy was abused in, I think, two very significant ways. One, which was the trampling of individual rights, and also the way that decisions were made by the voting populace who weren't maybe as educated. Now, if anybody's listening who's studied this stuff in depth, I'm just going to say to them, I realize I'm on shaky ground because I've ventured over into perhaps Plato's critique of democracy, and I'm putting that in the mouth of Socrates. And I'll only say that I think that while Socrates wasn't anti-democratic in the way that Plato exposes himself to be, I think he had a lot of really significant questions about democracy in his day. And I think that's in part why he got into so much trouble.
Well, and what did it make you think when you say all of that? What did it make you think about where we are right now in this country and the democracy that exists in America in 2019?
I believe that democracy is always vulnerable to how we are persuaded. And I think that right now, although I didn't write this play about the present occupant of the White House, I think that there's a valency to that question when we wonder, well, why did, at least through the Electoral College, not the popular vote, why did we vote a person in who, by almost any metric, was not as qualified to be president as his opponent? But sometimes when the person less qualified on paper has been elected, that's probably been for the better because some of those people have turned out to be extraordinary leaders and have surprised us. So I guess in the spirit of Socrates, I'm interested in why this happens and in exploring, as Socrates would have said, and Plato as well, is this best? And if not, how do we repair it? And I believe that democracy itself is, like any form of government, an evolving form. And one of the reasons that I think I wanted to write this play and that the public decided to produce it is to explore how that happens.
I want to listen to another clip of Socrates from the play. Here it is.
One thing I've learned in 70 years is that man is well suited for tyranny, but especially when that tyranny is disguised as democracy.
What do you make, Tim Blake Nelson, of the fact that Socrates was condemned to death in a democracy?
Well, he was voted so. It was a jury, so not everyone voted, but it was a pretty large jury of 501. They voted first to find him guilty, and then by an even greater margin, they voted that he be executed as representing the people's will. So you could certainly argue on quite firm grounds that this was a democratic act. However, democracies can tyrannize. This is why we have something called the Bill of Rights in this country, to balance the rights mm-hmm. of the individual against what we call mob rule.
Has your study of Socrates, to put this play on, made you think in a different way than you did before? Or has it changed how you think?
It has changed how I think, and I've become more passionately, firmly interested in the responsibility of the voter to be informed and to think of a polity, of a democracy, as something larger than what's within eyesight of the individual. And I think that what Socrates spent his life pursuing, which was learning, he sought knowledge from others. And I would like to pursue learning, mm-hmm. certainly for the rest of my life, and that is probably a pursuit that every voter in his or her way might engage in.
You know, every time I have to go on the air to raise money for public radio in a pledge drive, that is the message I always bring, which is we live in the most powerful country on earth. We have a responsibility to be educated and informed more than anybody else about what's going on.
I completely agree. And I think that in a strange way, right now, if one is responsible in pursuit of that knowledge, even though there's a lot of shouting going on and a lot of partisanship, really, we all have a plethora of venues where we can go and hear, sometimes experience, different points of view. And it's, I think, a real cornucopia out there. You can really get a taste of everything.
And that's just Twitter. That is Tim Blake Nelson, whose new play is called Socrates. It is being performed at the Public Theater in New York through June the 2nd. Thank you so much for joining us.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, Jeremy.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wants the U.S. to play a bigger role in the Arctic, in part to compete with Russia and China. Yesterday, Pompeo addressed the 11th ministerial meeting of the Arctic Council, which wrapped up today in Finland. Victoria Herman is president and managing director of the Arctic Institute. That's a think tank focused on the region. Victoria, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a meeting that happens roughly every 2 years. Representatives from countries that border the Arctic Ocean meet to discuss pressing issues. China wants to be a part of that discussion. Let's listen to a little bit of what the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had to say about that yesterday in Finland.
Beijing claims to be a near Arctic state, yet the shortest distance between China and the Arctic is 900 miles. There are only Arctic states and not Arctic states. No third category exists, and claiming otherwise entitles China to exactly nothing.
What about that, Victoria?
Well, unfortunately, Secretary Pompeo is incorrect. In the Arctic Council, there is a third category, observer states, and China has been an observer state since 2013. They are allowed to be at Arctic Council ministerial meetings and are there to engage in scientific cooperation and collaboration, not just with the states, but also with indigenous groups.
What is China's interest in the Arctic?
China has a number of interests in the Arctic. One is that scientific cooperation. They have, of course, have economic ambition, having investment in Greenland, in Iceland, and in the polar shipping routes from eastern to western markets.
Pompeo also took aim at Russia, which has expanded its military presence in the region. He described it as a pattern of aggressive Russian behavior in the Arctic. What about the interests of Russia? And is there a possibility of military conflict in the Arctic anytime soon?
There's no real possibility of hot military conflict in the Arctic. The most aggressive actor in this ministerial meeting has been the United States. And for the first time since it was established in 1996, the Arctic Council ministerial meeting has not reached a joint declaration. That is because the United States did not want to sign onto any declaration that included the words climate change. But Russia is really putting more investment, more infrastructure, and more people back into its Cold War sites. There hasn't been much more than that, and most of that is focused on getting that infrastructure in place to capture the ships that will be going through the Northern Sea Route.
Now, climate change is obviously a key part of what's going on in the Arctic because as the seas warm, there are shipping routes that are opening up and all kinds of changes will happen as a result of more ability to pass through the Arctic, which much of it is in ice right now.
Absolutely. Each year, we are seeing a few more ships go through the Northern Sea Route, which hugs the Russian coastline. Ultimately, there are three sea routes that connect eastern to western markets, but those will need to wait till more ice melts in the north. And even when we see longer ice-free summers, there's still uncertainty over where those ice flows will be and ensuring that we still have ice-capable ships going through.
When you say the North, I just can't get Game of Thrones out of my head at this moment.
A lot of similarities.
That's Victoria Herman, who is president and managing director of the Arctic Institute. Victoria, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The sports world is still buzzing about Caster Semenya, the South African runner and gold medalist who reignited a debate about gender last week when the International Association of Athletics Federations ruled that if she wants to continue competing, she must take drugs that suppress the high levels of testosterone her body naturally produces. Now, reports about Semenya often conclude that because she has more testosterone than the average woman, she must be intersex. We want to be clear. Semenya herself has never said she is intersex, but intersex activists support her, and some people listening in on the debate have wondered, what does that even mean? We want to find out more. So a note, this conversation may be a little mature for some ears, lots of biology. Courtney Finlayson is a pediatric endocrinologist at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Dr. Finlayson, you have many intersex patients. We know that that means, very simply, just to start, their genitalia may be different from how it's presumed it would be.
In essence, that's part of it, yes. Sex development is a biological term that's used to describe the process by which sex chromosomes, like X and Y chromosomes, gonadal tissue, which is usually ovarian or testicular, and internal and external genitalia form. And one of the most important things is to understand how the process usually occurs to understand how differences can happen. So it begins at conception, and most is completed by the end of the first trimester of pregnancy. And when babies are forming, all babies, boys and girls, start out exactly the same. They start out with generic gonadal tissue, which can become ovaries or testicles. And then once those form, ovaries or testicles make hormones that tell internal structures like the uterus in females or seminal vesicles in males and external structures like the clitoris or the penis to become typically male or female. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of little steps that have to occur exactly for development into what people typically expect for boys or girls. And any little change causes a difference in that process of sex development.
So an infant could have, for instance, a female genitalia, a vagina, but also testicles. I'm kind of making up that combination.
Yes, that is possible. So there, for example, there are conditions like something called complete androgen insensitivity syndrome in which somebody has XY chromosomes, so typical for a boy, and they develop testicles. And the testicles make testosterone, but the body can't react to that testosterone. The receptor doesn't work. So it's almost as if no testosterone were ever made. And so people who have that condition may look completely female on the outside at birth.
And by the way, how many people are we talking about with this condition?
So it depends on exactly how you define it, but somewhere maybe between 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 5,000. So that means that these conditions are relatively rare, but they're common enough that you might easily know someone who has those traits. And people tend to keep this kind of information very private. And even among families, sometimes people may not know that a family member is affected.
Yeah. And there can be surgeries performed, you know, after a baby is born to, I'm making air quotes here, fix things.
So, yeah, you know, many individuals with these conditions have undergone some sort of surgery in the past and present. Some surgeries for infants or children who have these conditions is to remove gonadal, so ovarian or testicular tissue that has a risk of cancer. And in the past, it was recommended to remove that tissue as soon as the condition was diagnosed to avoid having it become cancerous, and because it was thought that that tissue would not make hormones or have any fertility potential. And the approach is evolving as we learn more about cancer risk and how that varies among different conditions. So sometimes the risk is low in early childhood and then rises in later adolescence or adulthood. And there might be some hormone function. So that removal of that tissue in childhood may not be essential or desirable. It may be reasonable sometimes to wait until an individual is older and can participate in that decision making. But I've also taken care of pediatric patients who have developed cancer. So as medical professionals in that situation, our duty is to present that information to patients and families, and they often agonize over those decisions, and ultimately some place greater value on potential gonadal function and others on avoiding cancer risk. The even more controversial is genitoplasty or surgery to change the external genitalia, and that may be for function or for appearance. And in the past, that was usually performed. And then particularly in the 90s, individuals with intersex traits began to speak out about their experiences. And some of them were very angry about the surgery that had been performed. You know, they may have had undesirable effects in terms of their future sexual function, or maybe they had a surgery that was done to make them appear more female, but they later identified as male. Mm. And so that's led to some changes, including increased discussion with parents about if and when genitoplasty should be performed, and changes in the surgical techniques with more effort to spare sexual function.
Yeah. Well, and this brings us to a bill that was introduced in California in January that would consider intersex surgery performed on minors to be the equivalent of genital mutilation. This is after activists came forward to say just what you said.
Right. So I think the discussion about if and when genitoplasty should be performed is very important, and it's a necessary discussion. But I think equating it to genital mutilation loses the complexity of the dilemma and may cause harm. You know, genital mutilation legislation was created to address concerns about ritual circumcision, and this is different. Mm. But as you said, the current legislative controversy essentially lies in whether these surgeries should be allowed in infancy and childhood when a parent is making a decision for a child, or whether any genital surgery should be prohibited until the individual can consent to their own procedure.
Well, what do you think, having worked in this field? I mean, yeah, it sounds as if there are pros and cons on both sides. There are people who've had this surgery who, you know, maybe are grateful for it, that they didn't have to go through a childhood of, you know, maybe bullying and confusion. And we're definitely hearing from activists who are saying they chose wrong, you know, and
right.
Yeah, I'm not who they thought I was. And now I live with genitalia that doesn't belong, that I don't feel belongs to me.
So I've spent a great deal of time thinking about this issue and discussing it with intersex advocates and with medical and surgical and mental health providers. And in some situations, I think delaying decisions about genital surgery may be the best option. But I'm not convinced that it's always the right decision, and that's where I think this becomes really complicated. So I'm concerned that not doing surgery is not a neutral decision. So individuals may be forced to live with a body that does not match their gender identity. And we don't know the implications of this in intersex individuals, but we do know in transgender minors, and I also take care of that population, we know that gender dysphoria can lead to self-harm and depression and anxiety, and that in those situations, typically the only thing that is useful is to treat with gender-affirming hormones, or for those individuals to undergo surgery. And so simply treating In the intersex population, simply trading always do surgery for never do surgery may not be the ideal solution. And I worry that in the effort to help some children, a surgical ban may hurt others.
We hear you on that, but what is a solution then if these infants, is there any other way to tell what an intersex newborn is meant to be?
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's important to realize that in any child who's born, you know, we don't actually know whether they're going to identify as male or female when they grow up. Mm. Only the child can tell us that as they grow up. And so my thought is that in this period of time where we don't know some of these answers, I think that when we approach these issues with families, I think that any family considering surgery for their child has to be exposed to the arguments for and against surgery from advocates and activists. They have to have an open discussion with their medical and surgical and mental health team. They have to discuss or sort of assess the decision methodically. And I think ultimately the parents have to make the best decision that they can for their child. I feel like as a physician, it's my duty to inform patients about all of their options and families. And as a pediatrician, I've learned great respect for parents. So in most circumstances, they know their child best, and they will do their very best to make the best decision they can for their child.
Dr. Finlayson, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Robin.
Dr. Courtney Finlayson practices at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. By the way, that vote in California on a bill that would ban intersex surgery, equate it with genital mutilation, was delayed until next year.
El Gato Montes, the wildcat, has been part of singer Placido Domingo's life since he was a kid.
And this is an opera that my parents used to sing.
Domingo is now 79. He was born in Spain and grew up with a genre of Spanish opera called zarzuela that combines elements of theater, folk music, and dance. This month, Domingo is performing in El Gato Montes with the LA Opera, as Stephen Cuevas reports.
It's been 25 years since Placido Domingo last performed El Gato here, though he's lived with the music his whole life. At age 17, he starred as the young, lovelorn bullfighter Rafael, a role he reprised in this 1992 recording. Toma esta caña de manzanilla. Relaxing on a dressing room couch after a costume fitting at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles, Domingo reflects on the last time he performed in El Gato. He was a tenor then. A decade ago, Domingo moved to baritone, a lower register, and a better fit for a still powerful but aging voice. For the first time, he'll perform the baritone role of the outlaw Juanillo, the eponymous El Gato himself.
I enjoyed very much the bullfighter, because the bullfighter, in a way, he has more to sing. But I think the part of the outlaw really ends at very, very touching.
With echoes of Puccini's Tosca, El Gato Montes tells the story of a fiery but doomed love triangle between a gypsy girl named Soleá and Rafael, the young apprentice bullfighter. But the true object of Soleá's desire isn't Rafael. It's El Gato, the fugitive, hiding out in the mountains after killing a man.
And we are doing a change in the opera. The character Soleá, she died in the original. Here, he takes her alive, and then, at the end, oh, maybe I don't tell you the end. maybe I shouldn't tell you the end. Let's make a mystery. But what I can say is then she leaves to sing in the third act gorgeous music with the old lover.
At an evening dress rehearsal just days before opening night, Domingo and soprano Ana Maria Martinez deliver a moving, if bloody, close to Act 3.
Mi vida. I want the people to know this opera. The Hispanic public is growing, and so they want to hear something in Spanish.
Evidence of that can be heard every Wednesday night in the largely Latino neighborhood of Boyle Heights near downtown Los Angeles, where zarzuela is taught and performed via the Zarzuela Project. It's drawn everyone from a Vietnam veteran there for his therapy to aspiring millennial singers. With a public performance just around the corner, the group of amateur singers rehearses the classic early 20th century zarzuela aria, Te Quiero Moreno, I Love You, Brown Girl.
Zarzuela music is being kept alive with the Zarzuela Project. Many of our spectators are hearing zarzuela for the first time.
The project is a partnership led by musician Richard Mata and his community-based mariachi conservancy with help from LA Opera and Plácido Domingo.
I feel that it's important for Plácido Domingo to continue that, especially since it's very dear to him. And I feel that this project is doing exactly that. Here in Los Angeles, where there's like so saturated with all these different styles and genres.
I really want to show to the world, wherever I have concerts and so on, what is the music that my parents used to sing and the music that I hear for the first time. Actually, I hear it from my mother when she was expecting me.
Last month, Plácido Domingo celebrated his 4,000th opera performance. Though he has no intention of retiring from the stage just yet, he does acknowledge that at 78, there are only so many performances left. This run of El Gato Montes could be one of the last times audiences have a chance to see him perform the music that launched his career over 60 years ago.
I have an international career of more than half century. So it means that they want me, and I will be the first one to say, that's it. I won't allow people to say it, oh, Plácido, stop. Some people say it, you know, because, I mean, you cannot please everybody.
The singing performances may indeed end soon, but Domingo is determined to keep conducting, mentoring young artists, and spreading the gospel of opera and zarzuela, remaining true to a favorite motto in recent years, if I rest, I rust. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.